A short word before we begin. This episode includes graphic descriptions of the death of children. Please take care. Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. Larry Mahoney's job required him to work three 12-hour shifts. Then he would get 3 days off. He had gotten off work at 7 a.m. that Saturday morning, having done two shifts back-to-back. It wasn't a bad job for a guy who hadn't made it through the 10th grade. It paid $11 an hour, which was pretty good in 1988. That would translate to about $30 an hour today. Mahoney stole a few hours sleep before his 15-year-old son woke him around noon. By 2 p.m., he was drinking at the Drifter's Tavern in Carrollton, a small Kentucky town named after the last signer of the Declaration of Independence. Carrollton is located between Louisville and Cincinnati on Interstate 71, very near where the Kentucky River flows into the Ohio. It's where the M&T chemical plant churned out chemical slush that became plastic and paint with Mahoney's help. Later, when asked, nobody he knew would call the 34-year-old Mahoney a big or nasty drinker. A quiet guy, he caused no fuss. His drink of choice was beer, usually sticking to Miller Lite. Of late, he had been troubled by his lack of success with the two women he had married and by the terrible misfortune that had befallen his young daughter, Shauna. She'd been born with spina bifida and needed a lot of medical intervention and care. That meant he owed doctors and hospitals a lot of money. What was a man to do? By three, he was at Tubby's Last Chance Tavern. The bartender would remember him drinking one Miller Lite over an hour's stretch. 2 hours later, he dropped by his parents' house. He seemed fine to them. By five or so, he showed up in Burlington, an hour away, to see his current girlfriend, who had a job at a pharmacy that also sold liquor. He got a six-pack there and went to a friend's house to share it with some pals. Then they all went to another guy's house to help him with a project, and everybody drank some more. By 10 that night, he'd been drinking vodka straight up for a while. When he said he was going home, his friends were so concerned he'd get stopped by the cops, they had taken his keys away from him. He already had one DUI. They knew he couldn't afford another. But when he assured them he would take the back roads and go straight home, just a short trip, they relented and handed his keys back. Where Mahoney wandered and what he drank in the next 50 minutes isn't clear, but he likely bought more alcohol. As it was getting close to 11, he drove his Toyota truck onto the 71 to go north, then changed his mind. He crossed the grass median to go south, and maybe the alcohol had gotten him turned around. Maybe he mistook the 71 for Route 277, which led home. Maybe he got confused by the road signs. In any case, he ended up driving safely, he thought, being sure to stay to the right of the dotted line, careful to stick to the speed limit. Trouble was, Mahoney was driving north on the divided highway's southbound lanes. Later, it would be determined that he traveled almost 3 miles going the wrong way, passing 14 vehicles and two tractor trailers on that busy Saturday night. When he came around a blind curve at mile marker 39, he saw a bus directly in front of him. It too was going the speed limit. There was no time to stop or even swerve. Almost 40 years later, Larry Mahoney is still the driver behind the nation's worst drunk driving accident. He would alone be held accountable. But there were others who ought to have shouldered some of the responsibility. And that's why we're here. Not to parse blame, but to understand it. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Hiya Health. There is something I think about a lot as a parent. Our kids are growing up on more ultra-processed food than any generation before them, and we're still figuring out what that means long-term.
And that's part of why we started using Hiya. A lot of kids' vitamins are basically candy, sugar, artificial dyes, all that stuff.
Hiya goes the opposite direction. These are chewable, zero sugar, and made with a blend of organic fruits and vegetables, plus essential vitamins.
And somehow the kiddo still likes them. They actually look forward to taking them, which is not something I expected.
And here's something every parent needs to hear. If getting your kids to eat vegetables feels like an impossible daily battle, Hiya's new Kids Daily Greens and Superfoods is a total game changer. It's basically chocolate milk stuffed with veggies. It's a green powder designed specifically for kids that's packed with 55 plus whole food sourced ingredients. Just mix a scoop with milk or a milk alternative and they'll actually drink it.
We've worked out a special deal with Hiya for their best-selling children's vitamin. Receive 50% off your first order.
To claim this deal, you must go to hiyahealth.com/COTC. This deal is not available on their regular website. Go to hiyahealth.com/COTC and get your kids the full body nourishment they need to grow into healthy adults. On the night of May 14, 1988, just a few miles before the crash, driver John Pierman had stopped to fill up the gas tank on the 11-year-old bus. It was still a ways to go to get back to Radcliffe, where parents waited for their kids to come back from a very good day at Kings Island, a theme park on the other side of Cincinnati. Radcliffe was a relatively small town of less than 20,000, located on the other side and south of Louisville. It was, and is, mostly a bedroom community for those stationed at the nearby Army base of Fort Knox. When Mahoney's headlights came into view, Pierman had no time to react. Later, accident reconstructionists would say he had about 3/4 of a second before the two vehicles collided. The bus traveled 1.94 seconds after it was hit before it came to a stop. The tired and sunburned 67 people on board, 63 kids and 4 adults, felt the collision. Some had been asleep. A few would later remember thinking that a tire had blown or that they had hit a deer. It was dark. There was some screaming. A few had fallen. A few had hit their heads on the seat in front of them. Everyone was dazed. The right front end of both vehicles had buckled. The pickup truck's cab flattened to the dash. The bus folded down as if kneeling. Pierman yelled for everyone to get out of the bus. Within seconds, an explosive ball of fire consumed the front of the bus. The flames raced to the roof, then climbed down the center aisle, headed to the back of the bus, where the only emergency exit was located. Some kids fought to open the small, 9-inch-wide upper windows next to their seats to get out. They kicked at the lower windows, but nothing budged. The few upper windows that opened fueled the fire within, and flames shot out the bus. Some were quickly succumbing to the toxic fumes inside, landing on the floor that was, by now, searingly hot and crowded, with kids pushing to get out. Two truckers had seen the crash and immediately leaped out of their cabs to help. They headed to the back of the bus and tried to wrest open the exit door. When they did, kids poured out. Only a few were unhurt physically. Some had visible burns on their arms, hands, faces. Some were already on fire. The kids, ages 10 to 18, dragged themselves and each other into the cool grass median as other drivers stopped to render aid, to offer blankets and comfort. The blankets proved to be painful additions as the skin on some of the survivors was already peeling off in sheets. At Mahoney's trial, the children testified.
People were crawling under the seats and people were just getting run over. Little kids were getting run over and it was just horrible.
Ran toward the back, crawled over everything in my way. Bodies, seats. And at the rear exit, it was completely packed with bodies.
And I was trying to get out, and finally when it cleared, I got conned over a seat, and the seat was so hot, it melted my right palm.
When they pulled me out, I was still on fire.
Jack Armstrong, a 51-year-old Kentucky farmer whose car had been trailing the bus, also stopped and set to saving those he could. Here's one witness describing the scene back in 1988.
Me and myself and the hand next to me in the next truck there on the side pried the back door open and started pulling the kids off the bus. We got a total of 9 kids off the bus before the second tank went off in the bus, and there's just too much flame, too much heat.
Here's an excerpt from Reckless Disregard, authored by James S. Coonan, about the accident and its aftermath. Quote, Karen Foran stood up when she heard everyone screaming fire, but she got kicked back down into the seat. No one would let me out, she said later. She had been using a big helium balloon as a pillow. It blew up and stuck to her face. Her hair and shirt were in flames as she struggled toward the door. Armstrong got her in his big knuckled hands and started to carry her away. He tore her burning blouse off. She got her arms around his neck, and when he tried to lay her down, she wouldn't turn him loose. She said she couldn't see. Armstrong hollered for his wife to come get her, and he got on the bus again. Groping along the floor, he felt another body lying in the aisle. He got hold of it and dragged it out. It appeared to be a little girl. She had big cuts across the knees and at first seemed to be dead. He laid her down behind the bus. He felt another body beneath hers. Armstrong was determined to get it. He crawled in and got part way back before the smoke got to him and he had to get out. Then he climbed in again and got the child. That was the last time he could get in. The smoke was too much. He guessed in practically 5 minutes, there was nothing anybody could do. End quote. On the grass separating I-71, 40 kids who had spent that glorious May Day on thrill rides watched as the bus continued to burn uncontrollably. Some were thanking God for saving them. Some were asking God what the hell had happened to them. Some searched in vain for their friends. As reality set in, there didn't seem to be much evidence a higher power had been watching over them. After all, they were riding on the Radcliffe Assembly of God church bus, a bus that had been prayed over by their pastor just that morning. He had blessed the bus and gave everyone the assurance that God would take care of them that day. Ambulances and fire trucks from surrounding jurisdictions got there in record time. Tommy Webb, a volunteer from the Campbellsville Volunteer Rescue Squad, knew that the bus and everyone left in it were gone. He approached the black Toyota. The truck's roof had been crushed, almost level with the dash. But here was the driver laid out, still breathing. Reaching in to hoist him into a better position to remove him from the truck, Webb touched the cold surface of 3 beer cans. 2 were unopened. 1 was half full. Finding the man's driver's license in his pocket, he saw Mahoney's name. He handed it to an ambulance driver who quickly determined that none of Mahoney's injuries were life-threatening. Medevac helicopters were taking the most critical to trauma centers in Louisville. Within 15 minutes of the crash, Carroll County Coroner James Dunn was on his way to the site that he had been told little about. When he got there, he surveyed the unexpected sprawl of complete decimation. He spoke to a state trooper and then climbed through the rear door. Coonan wrote, quote, directly in front of him, the tops of 2 skulls flashed in the beam of his light, the bare white bone streaked in crimson. 2 bodies were lying face down in the aisle where they fell, one atop the other. No, that was 3 bodies in a stack. He could just make out the one on the bottom. To the right of them, 2 bodies were draped over the back of a seat, their flesh seared tight to their ribs. End quote. It was as if one kid had fallen and the rest tried to climb over him or her or over the seats and had been caught by the smoke or the fire itself, which was later found to have raised the temperature inside the bus to 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit. The coroner, who was not a medical doctor, knew this was over his head. He called Dr. George Nichols, the state medical examiner who lived in Louisville. Dunn wanted to handle this right. He needed to preserve the scene. He knew that the parents needed that. He knew that law enforcement needed that. Lawyers would probably need that. He knew the public would want an explanation. Children had died. A lot of children. When he got to the scene, Dr. Nichols met a state trooper, and together, the two men approached the burned-out bus.
Met Jack at the back of the bus. The back door was open. There were no living victims at that point in the scene. I had a Cal Light and with both hands, used that to illuminate as much as I could. I saw a scene of absolute horror. Dead kids draped over the backs of seats, their bodies either completely or partially incinerated.
It was quickly decided to move the entire bus to a more secluded spot so that highway traffic and the Good Samaritans that had stopped to help wouldn't have to witness the parade of bodies being removed. Law enforcement reached a Carrollton construction company that found a crane and long bed truck for the job. The bus that had become the tomb for 27 people was taken to a nearby National Guard armory where, according to State Trooper Sonny Cease, it took 7 hours to separate the bodies from each other. Back in Radcliffe, the bus was late. There had been a call to the Reverend W. Don Tennyson at the Assembly of God Church about an accident, but he was given no specifics. Stand by. Church elders were called and found themselves in an odd position. Half of the kids on the trip weren't even from the church. They had tagged along or bought tickets for the Kings Island Spring Fling and gotten on this bus from Radcliffe. Pastor T, as everyone knew the Reverend, thought caution was best. Some parents were already in the parking lot waiting to pick up their kids after their big day out. Some were waiting for the church to call them, and those calls didn't come until almost 1 a.m. Eventually, they all gathered to hear from state police or somebody about where and when they could collect their children. Church administrators had tried to gather as much intel as they could, but they had been warned by local police against sharing unconfirmed rumors with anyone. So, all the parents waited, panicked. Some went home to make calls. Some went into the church to kneel on the carpeted altar and pray. Tennyson was told the bus driver was dead. He was a part-time minister, and this was devastating news. He had a wife and two kids, one of whom had even been on the bus. When word came that some kids had been taken to hospitals, church folks began calling around for more information. In the very early mornings of that Sunday, back in Radcliffe, a trooper called to tell the pastor that there were 17 fatalities. Pastor T stumbled. "Fatalities? You mean dead?" he asked. "Yes," said the trooper, "dead." The trooper asked to have the list of who had been on the bus. Tennyson told him that Youth Minister Chuck Kidda had the names in his briefcase. "Ask him. He's on the bus." "Pastor," the trooper said, "hasn't anybody told you that the bus burned? There is no briefcase. There is no bus." The only thing that was known was which of the children were alive. So, one by one, 40 sets of parents were called into the sanctuary and told where the ambulances had taken their children. Therese Searless, a nurse at Louisville's Cosair Children's Hospital, was working that night.
"It's heart-wrenching. Parents did not start arriving until about 3:30 in the morning, at which point in time you see just the anguish in their eyes diverting in every direction, looking for any type of familiarity. You could just see their hearts in their hands, looking for their children, giving the names of these children, and we didn't know the names of these children."
All this time, one man stood apart from the rest. Lee Williams' two girls, Kristen, age 14, and Robin, 10, had been on the bus. So had his 34-year-old wife, Joy, who had gone along as a chaperone of the bus trip. The girls were his life, he later told documentary makers Jason Epperson and Harold Dennis. This is from the documentary called Impact After the Crash.
"Boy, I tell you what, I do remember that night. I was just kind of beginning, I quit praying and I began to bargain with God. God, will you spare at least two? And I didn't say which two. And about 6 o'clock in the morning, I was so desperate. You know, it's amazing what you'll say when you're desperate. I said, God, I don't want to be left alone. If I have to lose one or two, will you just leave me somebody? I'm begging you. Yeah, you go from prayer to bargain to begging.
His pleas went unanswered. He lost his whole family that night. By 9:30 a.m. that Sunday, the parents who had not been summoned to hospitals were told that a van would come to take them to Carrollton. The parents weren't clear on what they were going to be asked to do. Maybe some of the kids were unconscious or had no ID. In the ride over, they were asked to write down what their children had been wearing. Any identifying jewelry? But when they pulled up at a Holiday Inn and were ushered into a banquet room, most knew the worst had happened. When Dr. Nichols began to speak to them, they understood all too well. He told them to remember their children as they once were, those smiling faces and the pictures in their wallets, because now they would not recognize them and they wouldn't be asked to. Others would do that awful work. There was no reason they needed to do the identifying. Their children had all been burned beyond recognition. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Mint Mobile.
Can we talk about phone bills for a second? Because I feel like every time mine hits, I'm annoyed all over again.
It's never just the number you signed up for. They always seem to sneak in extra fees and so-called perks you didn't ask for.
Right. It's like they're hoping you won't look too closely.
Which is exactly why Mint Mobile exists. They're basically saying, what if wireless didn't have to be that complicated or that expensive?
And they've actually pulled it off. Plans start at $15 a month.
And I've heard this firsthand. My friend John switched to Mint and loves it. He said moving his existing number over was super easy, which is the part most people worry about.
And you're still getting high-speed data and unlimited talk and text on the nation's largest 5G network.
Which is why this plan is what I'm looking at for when the kiddo gets a phone. I just don't see the point in paying big wireless prices if you don't have to.
Especially for a kid's line.
Exactly. If you like your money, Mint Mobile is for you. Shop plans at mintmobile.com/COTC. That's mintmobile.com/COTC. Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month 5 gigabyte plan required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customer offer for first 3 months only, then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See Mint Mobile for details. The crash, the deaths, and the volume of funerals that followed placed an unbearable burden on the small community. The questions that were repeated over and over were twofold. Who was responsible, and why had God allowed this? The first, the who, was easy. Sort of. An hour and a half after the collision, Mahoney's blood alcohol concentration was measured at 0.24%. By all rights, he should have passed out or puked long before the crash. A blood alcohol researcher would later tell a jury that Mahoney's estimate that he had had 7 or 8 beers between 2 and 11 p.m. was woefully inaccurate. It had to have been more like 18 or 19. That's if he'd been drinking regular beer. If Mahoney had indeed been drinking light beer, as he had said, he likely had downed closer to 24 cans to get that drunk. At that time in Kentucky, it was illegal to drive if you had a blood alcohol level of 0.1%. Mahoney's was more than twice that. The Carroll County Commonwealth's attorney duly charged Mahoney with 27 counts of capital murder. He said he would seek the death penalty 27 times. That seemed fair to the parents of the dead and many in the nation that were appalled by the carnage. But was Mahoney alone to blame? Early that first week, after the bodies had all been autopsied, Dr. Nichols made a startling conclusion. No one would have died had there been no fire.
I found no evidence of incapacitating injury, let alone lethal injury, in anyone as the result of the collision.
No broken bones, no fractured skulls, no one had been impaled by sharp objects, no one had suffered a seizure or a heart attack or brain injury. They all died because the bus fire had happened so fast and so fiercely. So, who was responsible for that? Was it the fault of whoever designed a school bus that put the unshielded gas tank on the outside of the bus's underlying frame next to the main and only entrance? Was it the guy who put the only other exit at the back? Or the guy who okayed the choice of seat materials? Who said it was okay that if the seat burned, they would release toxic fumes that would fell those escaping them? Or maybe it was the regulatory agencies who said bus accidents were so rare the buses could forego these safety features and just be fire traps. Who in God's name said that was perfectly fine? Trade a few kids for a few dollars. Cost-benefit analysis, you know. And finally, who had spent more time fighting bus safety regulation than caring about safety? Because remember, Mahoney was essentially fine. His truck was totaled, but he had crashed head-on with a school bus and walked away virtually unscathed. The medical examiner's findings indicated that the bus riders should have too. It became clear that Ford Motor Company and Scheller Globe Corporation both knew on the Monday morning after the crash that these questions would be asked, so they rushed in to quell the questions and settle with the bereaved. Just behind them was the National Transportation Safety Board, the NTSB, which that Monday night informed the press that this bus had not been equipped with a metal cage to protect the gas tank from puncture. But the government had fixed that bus flaw, they tried to reassure. School buses of the type that was involved here had added the cage to comply with a federal regulation for safety that went into effect on April 1, 1977. That is, every bus manufactured after that date had to have the cage. No word yet on when this bus was manufactured. They'd keep the public in the loop. Someone had the idea to invite the parents of all on board, those who survived and those who didn't, to join a group so they could face what came next together. They would call themselves the Family Support Group. It was likely the idea of a local law firm, Skeeters and Bennett, who were on hand that first night at the request of one of the parents to explain what lay ahead, legally speaking. They made it clear that they weren't going to sue the church. That would be wrong, they said. But retainer contracts could be signed that very night if everybody was in agreement that others should be held accountable. Let's get some justice. Pretty quickly, a representative of an insurance company that covered the Assembly of God and 12,000 other churches came sweeping in. They offered the whole group $1 million to be paid out on the basis of need. Those who had lost a child would be given $1,000. Those who had children injured would be given $10,000. That struck the grieving parents as ludicrous. What was really going on here? Their dead children mattered less than those who had lived? Emotions were high, voices were loud. Who could be trusted? What did they want? What could fix this? The group continued to meet. A month after the crash, a California-based lawyer named Brown Green presented himself as available as well. He had successfully litigated on behalf of Pinto fuel tank victims when they successfully sued Ford for similar fire-related design flaws. He made it clear that Ford and Scheller Globe, the two manufacturers of the bus in question, knew very well that fuel tanks on buses had to be shielded in case of impact. Anyone who wanted to talk automotive structural engineering was invited to a separate meeting. Only two families showed up to that. Lieutenant Colonel Lawrence Fair and his wife Janie, the parents of 14-year-old Shannon Fair, who had, per her autopsy, died of carbon monoxide poisoning but had lived the longest on that bus, and Jim and Carolyn Nunnally, the parents of Patty Nunnally, who, at just 10, was tied as the youngest to die. Skeeter and Bennett had courted the rest of the parents and were already meeting with Ford and Scheller Globe to arrive at some monetary figure for the parents that they said was meant to avoid lengthy delays and a rollout of evidence that was too horrifying to imagine. Besides, Ford spokesman Robert Munson had assured them they had no reason to think the location of the gas tanks was remotely problematic or that the tank itself was anything but safe. The Fairs and the Nunnallys felt pressured to join in the action. They didn't want to be rushed. and they did not want to make this easy for Ford. Then John Cole, a senior partner at an international firm that handled cases against Union Carbide after a gas leak in Bhopal, India, reached out to the Fairs and realized they wanted something more than money. They wanted better school bus safety. He told them he was willing to press Ford for as long as that took. They hired him. They didn't care about money. They told him they would hold out for more government regulation and more public awareness of school bus safety issues. They wanted manufacturers to be forced to build better buses and, if possible, better cars. Then Annalise chose a different law firm, but they wanted the same thing. They even offered to take $1 in exchange for Ford agreeing to recall the buses they had manufactured before 1977 in order to equip them with gas tank cages. Ford declined that, though a spokesman said the company might consider a recall, but it wasn't going to be part of any legal settlement. Quick aside, they never recalled those buses. On the same day that Nunnally's made their generous offer, Skeeter and Bennett held a press conference to say that 24 of the families who had had a family member die in the crash had accepted a settlement. It was just 7 weeks after the crash. While the terms of the agreement were supposed to be secret, the news soon got out that Ford and Schiller Globe were paying more than $40 million for the victims' families for this all to go away. The money was divided in a reasonably equitable way. Some $750,000 was paid to 24 families whose children had perished. The adults who died, because of their known earning potential, and the families that were left without a breadwinner, received more. The families of the injured were paid on a sliding scale, with the most severely hurt receiving more than those less so. Ford and Schiller Globe also paid $500,000 to support efforts to curb drunken driving. The money eventually went to Mothers Against Drunk Driving. The two corporations had successfully settled this before any lawsuit had been filed against them, before they had to accept any public blame for the deaths. A Ford spokesman said the good people of Radcliffe had shown the country, quote, what kind of people they are, end quote. I think I hear a note of condescension there. On July 11th, the kind of people that the Fairs were was made clear. They filed suit against Ford and Schiller Globe. They alleged that both companies knew and consciously disregarded the danger they had built into the school buses. The Nunnally's filed suit the same day. The battle lines were drawn, and things were about to get very ugly. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Wildgrain.
I kind of want to become bread people.
But not the type who make it from scratch. We don't have time for that.
Nope, that's where Wild Grain comes in. It's a box that shows up with sourdough breads, pastries, even fresh pasta. And everything baked straight from frozen.
Exactly, you just throw it in the oven and in about 25 minutes, it smells like you've been baking all day.
Croissants are dangerous.
They really are, and the sourdough is legitimately good. You can taste the difference. It's made with simple ingredients and that slow fermentation process, so it doesn't feel like typical store-bought bread.
It also solves that what do we have in the house problem.
It's one of those things where you don't think you need it until it's there and suddenly you're using it all the time. Breakfast, dinner, random, we need to get something good right now moments. Imagine having fresh bakery quality bread, pastries, and pasta at home without any trips to the store. And don't just take my word for it. They have over 40,000 five-star reviews and have been voted the best food subscription box by USA Today for 3 years in a row.
For a limited time, Wild Grain is offering our listeners $30 off your first box, plus free croissants for life, when you go to wildgrain.com/COTC to start your subscription today.
That's $30 off your first box and free croissants for life when you visit wildgrain.com/COTC, or you can use promo code COTC at checkout. In 2018, the latest date I could find data for, 25 million children got onto 485,000 buses every school day. In theory, school buses should be among the safest vehicles on the road. In fact, school buses, which travel slow and stop often while other drivers must wait behind them, are considered as such. According to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, school buses are 8 times safer than passenger cars. The height of the seats and the close spaces allowed between seats provide for a kind of safety compartment inside the bus. Between 2007 and 2016, only 58 occupants of buses were killed. Twice as many children were killed in the cars that hit those buses. But there had been a few notable, tragic instances during the middle of the century that brought bus safety, or the lack of it, to the public's attention. Some children had died when a bus was hit and plunged into a river. More died when hit by a train, and a few more died when the bus's brakes failed in 2 separate instances. That prompted the House subcommittee responsible for overseeing the NHTSA to take up the matter of bus safety in 1984, as some members of Congress did not understand bus manufacturer math. They were asking why the costs of making buses safer tended to outweigh the costs in deaths and injuries. More specifically, why was it unreasonable to ask for a reinforcement of body side panels, $300 to $400 per bus, and emergency window exits at $12 per window to reassure American parents? The committee was told by American bus manufacturers that school systems were not flush with cash and that, in a lowest bid wins competition for purchase, the less safe but cheaper option would win the day. A few $100 made a difference. Now, admittedly, back in 1974, buses cost about $8,000. Today, a standard bus costs between $100,000 and $150,000. So, a few $100 did matter more back then. To appear accommodating, those who testified against the safety standards assured the committee that they were working on better seats, better joint strength, and better windows already. Congress did not think those promises were enough. They decided to mandate that those safety standards, as well as ones that protected gas tanks, should be put into effect no later than October 27, 1976. That date was later pushed to April 1, 1977. But wait, Ford and other bus manufacturers like International Harvester were still actively opposing the newly mandated bus fuel integrity standards. It would later be discovered that President Nixon, Henry Ford II, Ford President Lee Iacocca, Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, and a raft of others had met in 1971 to talk about how Nixon could better support the automaker. Quick aside, we know this because it's White House Conversation 488-015, one of Nixon's taped Oval Office chats, which would ultimately prove his culpability in Watergate. Anyway, per the tape, Iacocca told the president, quote, "Safety has really killed a lot of our business."
And you can see that safety has really killed all our business, and it is really changing everything we know.
Nixon agreed with him and stood ready to help. It was just a few hours after that late morning conversation in April 1971 that Nixon called John Volpe, his Secretary of Transportation, and told him to, quote, "stop all regulations," end quote, on seatbelt buzzers and airbags. Nixon aide John Ehrlichman would later testify in a deposition in Fair v. Ford that this presidential directive was meant to be a sweeping gesture aimed at all vehicle safety regulations. So, in 1976, though Nixon was gone and Gerald Ford was president, the rules in place at the Transportation Department had not changed. That meant that an extended time allowance had to be made for more public comment on the subject of cages for bus fuel tanks. It was around this time that Representative John McAllister, a Nebraska Republican, argued that $1,000 more spent on safety measures could be multiplied by over 30,000 buses sold every year. His math meant that school systems would be fronting more than $30 million in costs. Now, divide that by the number of kids killed on average every year, and you're saying each life is worth $1 million. He thought that was too much of an ask. Other members of Congress did not. But all that arithmetic must have been time-consuming, because the date of implementation of the congressional mandate, to the contrary, was postponed again, from April to July 1976. And because the government grinds slowly, that date was again pushed back to January 1, 1977, and then again to April 1, 1977. That's when it actually took effect. Three congressmen from the original committee that held those hearings took the unusual step of recording their dissent to the continued postponements in the congressional record. They even had their dismay read into the history of the original report. Finally, the Louisville Courier-Journal uncovered that the bus that carried 27 children to their deaths in 1988 was manufactured on March 23, 1977, 9 days before the cage requirements finally took effect, and well over a year after it was supposed to. The Fairs and the Nunnelys took the delay personally. To them, it was reckless disregard. It was murder. They figured if they confronted Ford, which built the chassis, and Scheller Globe, which built the bus's outer structure, the companies would see the error of their ways and want to make things right. Meanwhile, in Carroll County, Kentucky, the arrest of Mahoney was met by hostile courthouse crowds upset that their boy Larry was being held accountable for the terrible deaths of 27 kids. You heard me right. It was awful what happened to those kids, they told reporters. But should Larry really shoulder the blame? Who among us hasn't had a few drinks and then driven home? He hadn't meant to kill anybody. He intended no harm. He wasn't a bad guy. The Commonwealth did not agree, of course, and neither did a lot of Kentuckians. But this was 1988, and drunk driving was not yet as widely seen as the inherent public danger that we know it to be. What everyone did seem to agree on was that juries should be allowed to determine intentionality in those kinds of deaths. That is, had Mahoney grossly deviated from reasonable conduct? Had he created a substantial and unjustifiable risk of killing someone but failed to perceive that risk? Had he been aware of the risk and consciously disregarded it? Had he shown extreme indifference to human life? The prosecutor soon took the death penalty off the case. But the wantonness of the crime clearly mattered. Did Mahoney commit murder or just manslaughter? If so, in what degree? The trial took 17 days, with testimony coming from 124 witnesses. A lot of that testimony was almost too horrible to sit through. The defense maintained that since no one died in the crash until the unsafe gas tank had exploded, Mahoney was not legally responsible for the deaths. The prosecutor said Mahoney set the whole thing into motion. If not for him, the gas tank would still be attached to the bus and those children would be alive. Throughout the trial, Mahoney appeared remorseful to the point of personal torment. He wept openly. He said he had gotten sober. Just 3 weeks after the bus crash he caused, one of his cousins, just 14 years old, had been killed in Carrollton, the victim of a drunk driver. That guy, by the way, got 5 years probation. It wasn't like Mahoney expected mercy, but no one knew what to expect.
We, the jury, find the defendant, Larry Wayne Mahoney, guilty of manslaughter in the second degree.
After 11 hours of deliberation, on December 21, 1989, Mahoney was found guilty of 27 counts of manslaughter in the second degree and 27 counts of wanton endangerment in the first. He was sentenced to 16 years in prison. He would be eligible for parole after 8. At last, Mahoney was free to speak to the families of those he'd killed.
I know that y'all been wanting me to say something and tell you that I'm sorry, and that's what I've been wanting to do. But I've been told not to say anything, so I want you to know that I really am sorry.
The families of the dead had wanted him to be sentenced to life in prison. They had wanted some kind of real deterrent to highlight the scale of his crime. They were bitterly disappointed. The Fair and Nunnally families, the ones who thought they could shame two large American corporations into doing the right thing, were about to be disappointed again, but not for lack of trying. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Hims.
I feel like this is one of those things that a lot of guys deal with, but almost nobody actually wants to talk about.
Yeah, it's definitely not a go-to conversation topic.
No, but it should be, because ED is way more common than people think. And the bigger issue is that a lot of guys just put off doing anything about it.
Even though there are options.
And that's what I like about Hims.
It's all online.
Yeah, you just complete a simple online intake, a licensed provider reviews your information, and if treatment is right for you, they prescribe it. And it ships directly to your door in discreet packaging.
Which removes a lot of the barriers right there.
And they offer different options depending on what works for you. That includes sildenafil, the generic of Viagra, and it can cost up to 95% less than the brand name version if prescribed.
That is a big difference.
And if that option isn't the right fit, there are other treatments available too. It's not one size fits all. It's about finding what actually works for you.
To get simple online access to personalized, affordable care for ED, hair loss, weight loss, and more, visit hims.com/COTC. That's hims.com/COTC for your free online visit.
hims.com/COTC. Prescription required. See website for details and important safety information. Sildenafil is the generic version of Viagra. Viagra is a registered trademark of Viatris Specialty LLC. Hims is not affiliated with or endorsed by Viatris.
The Fares and Nunnally's had hoped against hope that the corporations with unsafe buses out on America's streets would want them recalled and fixed to be safer. They quickly learned that hope was misplaced. The 3-year legal battle that followed consisted of the Fares and Nunnally's demanding to see every document Ford had generated concerning school buses. The two companies refused, then delivered when courts ordered them to. It was a painful, endless, mind-numbing process of discovery. The families found a lot of damning evidence. They would argue that it was corporate policy at Ford Motor Company not to add safety equipment until required by law. The families knew Ford had known what was safe and what wasn't. They had just chosen not to implement it. It boiled down to this. Ford argued that Kentucky's Division of Pupil Transportation didn't have any gas tank cage specifications in place when buying the bus. The plaintiffs, and the NTSB for that matter, argued that the company usually assisted buyers in knowing what specifications they should ask for. In response, Ford argued that, quote, Kentucky was a highly sophisticated school bus purchaser, end quote. In other words, they didn't need the company's help. On February 10, 1992, Schiller Globe at least relented. It gave each family $1.3 million apiece. The company was already out of the bus building business and wanted this thing over. To slay Ford would take more. No outcome was assured, and bills were piling up. It was going to be a long slog. As the New York Times later noted, quote, ours is a system of competing interests, and in the end, even though Shannon Fair's parents had damning corporate documents and a sympathetic judge, the system would only push Ford so far. With jobs at risk, costs to control, markets to defend against the Japanese, and litigation costs soaring, even the Fair's lawyers told them, settle. So they did, end quote. Ford paid each family $5 million. As author Koonin wrote, the automaker could have settled for less out of pocket by giving the Fares and Nunnally's, quote, some sort of good faith commitment to contribute to the improvement of bus safety, end quote. After all, that's really what the families wanted. Instead, Ford spent millions to avoid doing what consumers wanted done in the name of safety. They had justified 27 children's deaths as the cost of doing business. The families didn't get Ford to recall those buses, but their fight changed things anyway. Federal standards are higher now, and states can opt to make them even stricter. A state regulator told WLKY-TV,
the average school bus specification probably contains around 45 to 50 pages. The Kentucky specification encompasses more than 120 pages.
Louisville's WHAS-TV reporter Robert Bradfield spoke to Paul Richwalski, the man who prosecuted Mahoney in 2019.
Since 1988, the legally impaired blood alcohol level decreased to 0.08. Kentucky now also requires some DUI offenders to install an ignition interlock system where drivers must prove they are not drunk before starting their vehicle. And he says the biggest change came not by changing laws.
I think the major change that I have seen in 31 years, and I think what started with this particular case was public perception and attitudes.
Kentucky now also requires every school bus to have 9 emergency exits. That's more than federal law requires and more than any other state mandates. The state also requires all school buses to run on either diesel or propane gas, as both have higher flammability points than gasoline. And as Richwalski said, the crash shined a light on the problem of the number and danger of drunk drivers on America's roadways. As such, the number of fatalities caused by drunk driving declined in the 1990s and early 2000s. For reasons that remain unclear, drunk driving deaths have surged 25% since 2014. According to 2023 data compiled by the NHTSA, 34 people die every day in a drunk driving-related crash. The Fares and the Nunnally's continued to fight for stricter bus safety and more public awareness about drinking and driving. Janie Fair became a frequent sight on Capitol Hill, lobbying for more stringent efforts to control drunk driving. She served as the national vice president of MAD. Carolyn Nunnally became MAD's national president in 1998. Their efforts are responsible for the passage of federal laws that incentivized states to lower their legal blood alcohol content limit to 0.08%. Larry Mahoney earned his GED while at the State Reformatory, a medium security prison in LaGrange, Kentucky. He attended Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. He was offered an early release after serving 6 years because he was considered a model prisoner. He declined the offer and served about 10 years before he was released. Karen Foran, the teenager who had rested her head on a helium balloon and suffered severe burns when it flashed in the fire, exchanged letters with Mahoney while he was in prison. She wanted to forgive him. In 2017, she told documentary makers that, quote, "He was a country boy that made a mistake," end quote. The Cincinnati Enquirer reported in 2003 that Mahoney was living a simple life in a rural part of Owen County, just 10 miles from where the crash occurred. His friends told the Courier-Journal in 2013 that Mahoney has remained sober. To research this case, journalist Amy Wilson read Reckless Disregard, Corporate Greed, Government Indifference, and the Kentucky School Bus Crash by James S. Coonan. She read archival newspaper reports of the crash as well as retrospectives published in later years. So you know, the Louisville Courier-Journal won the 1989 Pulitzer Prize for general and spot news reporting for their work on the crash and its aftermath. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grab Bag Collab. Head to www.grabbagcollab.com for exclusive content related to this show and access to other series on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and sometimes my child, Hunt Van Benskoten. Other music comes from Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, please help us out by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts. Also, tell your friends. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're @centuriespod, and you can find us on the Crimes of the Centuries Facebook page.